So a lot of dating is like a Disney movie. Engagement can be like a Disney movie where you're pretty sure that you've met Prince Charming or Cinderella and everything is perfect. I've sat with a multitude of couples in their engagement and they've never fought and they have twinkly eyes for each other and they're sure they're never going to fight. They've even said that before and I'm pretty quick to say, I'll be seeing you pretty soon. That's engagement. And then when you get married, sometimes it's like a Disney movie in reverse, and you kind of feel like you got lied to. It's not Prince Charming anymore. Somehow they reverted back into the Beast, and I know that's a mixing of Disney movies, but you get the point. And you're pretty sure she's not a princess, but she's a witch, and that's not a real Disney movie, but that's the movie that you find yourself in. And Solomon and his wife want to deal with some of these issues. And so this week we're going to talk rejection and how we respond. Next week, we'll talk fighting and how we respond. And the things that Solomon and his wife teach us are helpful for marriage and all aspects of life. So it's applicable to all of our friendships, all of our community, and all of our marriage. And so whether you're married or single, this is certainly for you today. Let's jump right in. If you have a Bible, turn to Song of Solomon in the Old Testament. We'll start with chapter 5, verse 2 says this. I slept, but my heart was awake, a sound. My beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, and my locks with the drops of night. Okay, so she's sleeping, but not really sleeping very well. Sleep is a fragile thing. You might know that already. Caffeine affects sleep, which is a cruel thing in life and a sign of the fall. Food affects sleep. You can eat too late and have bizarre dreams. When you have a kid, you learn this. Sleep begets sleep. So if you have a baby that's not sleeping and you take it into the doctor and you say, my baby's not sleeping, the doctor's going to say your baby's not sleeping because it's not sleeping. And if the baby could sleep more, it would sleep more. And you think you just had a lobotomy and the doctor is trying to make you insane. But that's the nature of sleep. Sleep is fragile. One of the things that affects it most is relational friction. If you're in a relationship with somebody and you love them and you get into it with them and it's heated and it's tense, you can go to sleep, fall asleep, but you're going to be pretty restless. You're going to wake a lot. And the interesting thing is this. You wake and immediately that relational friction is right there. It doesn't take a minute to remember it. It doesn't take 5 minutes to kind of recount the events. It seizes you immediately and it grabs hold of you. And that's what's happening in this passage. Solomon came home really late. The dew has already fallen. It's past midnight. It's well into early morning. And Solomon's wife worried about him. Put yourself in her shoes. You made dinner. You were waiting to have dinner with him. He said he would be there. He didn't show up. You waited a little bit longer. You ate alone. You talked to some friends to busy yourself. You read a book a little bit. You even cleaned the closet. If you come home and your spouse is cleaning a closet, it's a sure sign you're about to get lit up, okay? That's what's happening. In her heart, there are all these different emotions. And she starts with frustration. I can't believe he's doing this again. It builds into mild anger. And then it meanders pretty quickly over here. Maybe he's hurt. Maybe he got into a car wreck. And then it goes quickly back over here. No, he's doing this intentionally. This is just how he's wired. This is who he is. And so you feel like you're going insane. Now, scholars think that Solomon is at work, that Solomon is a workaholic. And that strikes a chord with us because a lot of us here are workaholics. His life work arrangement wasn't working. And for you, a lot of us, our life work arrangements aren't working. You have little time for friends and community because you work too much. You have little time with your kids and your spouse. You're not using your spiritual gifts on any level at all. You're slowly dying because all you do is work and work and work. You'll go home and you'll think back over the day and you'll be pretty encouraged at first because you realize that you put 10, 12 hours in and you accomplished a lot and you feel like there was some significance to your work, but then you pull up your phone and you look at Wunderlist and you realize that you have more to do than you started with in that day and it depresses you pretty quickly and it sets in that maybe you should work again after dinner, after the kids are to bed, and you just endlessly work. That's the nature of a lot of our jobs. We don't have jobs, many of us, that clock in and clock out at 8 hours. Your teachers, you work way too much. Your doctors, your programmers, your engineers, your full-time parents, which is a 26-hour-a-day job. You just work and you work and you work. And it's killing you. It's overwhelming you. It's tough. And so after you work a day like that, you have to come to a pretty hard dilemma. Do you go back to work, or do you finally stop and have relationship and life? See, studies say this: Americans work more hours per week and more weeks per year than any other country on the planet. Studies also say that we have more resources, more money, more gadgets, more food, larger houses, more cars than any other planet on the face of the earth. And yet, we're less fulfilled, less healthy, and less happy than most countries on the planet, indicating pretty clearly that our work-life arrangements simply aren't working. And the pushback is pretty simple: but it's my livelihood. It's my job. It's my career. And if I don't work at this rate, I'm not going to be able to keep my job. Yet, it's killing you. And it's killing your relationships and your life, health. And something has to change sooner or later. And the only way change is going to happen is if you take really significant, important things and you stop doing them. Right? Don't miss that. This is not slight tweakings of your schedule to make everything perfect. That you can be a workaholic and have great relationships. You're going to have to take really important things and set it on the table and say, I can't do that anymore. For me, it means some pretty tangible things. One of the greatest privileges for me as a pastor of this church is to meet with people. I meet with about 15 folks a week, and I love that. It's an honor. And some of the folks here are really struggling and suffering. It's overwhelming to you. And my job is giving me access to a lot of the resources of the church, and so I can come beside you and offer some help, whether it's from my experience or somewhat wisdom, or it's helping you get help. And so I want to walk with you, but I have to tell you no lots of times. Not because I want to, not because you're not important, but I can't sacrifice my family. And that's a real important thing. Or for some reason, I have lots of opportunities to go and speak about Jesus to other places. I probably could speak 100 times a year outside of Vintage and stand in front of people. And I count this the greatest privilege of my life, that I can try with my placid words to winsomely communicate the loveliness and grandeur and mercy upon mercy of a great God named Jesus, and that he's chased you all the days of your life and he knows you. And I can go and do that and try to win people for the greatness of Jesus. And yet, more often than not, I have to say, I can't. I have to leave opportunities for success on the table and money on the table. I have to tell people I love no. And I have to do that because of this one reason. And this is the difficulty that you have to deal with if you're a workaholic. Neglect is neglect no matter what. And that's heavy. You can be doing something valid. You can be doing something important. You can be doing something spiritual. But if you're neglecting your friends and your community, if you're neglecting your wife, your husband, and your kids for your job, for success, for fulfillment, for even calling, then there's no way that would fly with Jesus. There's no way that you would sit in the presence of Jesus and explain, but you told me to do this. And he would say, quickly, no, I entrusted to you this daughter of God, the son of God. And that's the thing that's more important. And so we're going to have to come to a place where we realize our workaholic attitudes and perspectives and patterns are crushing us, and own that and give up important things so we can have the more important thing, the more significant thing. Now, I realize some of you guys are working two and three jobs to make ends meet, and I'm certainly not coming against you at all. I'm proud of you for doing that. And if you're in that place, I realize how difficult that is, and we would love to walk beside you as a church and try to alleviate that. So I'm not speaking to you, but I am speaking to the ones who have these workaholic patterns. Hear me well. If it's between work and marriage, choose marriage every time. If it's between work and community, choose your friends every time. You see, for a lot of us, it's not that we're trying to make ends meet, but we bought houses that are so large, we spend more than we make, we have to work and work and work to keep pace. Or we think that our work is going to give us some validation of self or make us into a place where other people know us. We want to be popular and known. We're still struggling with that same thing. And so we just dive in more, trying to leave our mark on this planet. Now, Solomon has a lot to say about this. He says it in Ecclesiastes, another book that he wrote. Listen to what he says in chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, verses 2 through 4. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit does man gain by all the toil under the sun? A generation comes and another generation goes, but the earth remains forever. Now, this word vanity is really important. The literal translation is vapor or mist or cloud. And so Solomon is saying that we are giving our lives over in our workaholic tendencies to chase bubbles, to chase clouds, to chase mist. And right when you get it, it's gone. I saw this happen at the state fair this week. I was there for 6 hours, which is pretty much 6 hours of purgatory for me, but my kids love it. And so we were there forever on Friday afternoon into the evening. And they have this new gun at the state fair that shoots bubbles. Now, when I was growing up, we had bubble guns, but it would shoot like one bubble. Everything would spill out the front and you'd have to just constantly fill it up. These guns are shooting like thousands of bubbles. The whole fair is full of bubbles this year. And you see little kids running around chasing bubbles, and they're running into vendors and running into each other. And it's great entertainment for a jerk like me. It's normal to see a 3-year-old do that, maybe even a 6-year-old do that. But Solomon is saying, as 33-year-olds, as 26-year-olds, as 49-year-olds, you're chasing bubbles at the state fair. You catch one, it pops on your finger. You would think that you would realize it didn't do what you thought it would do, and you would go pursue something else, but instead you see another bubble, and you run and you chase that one, and then a third and a fourth, and your whole life is pursuing, chasing after mist. He says this, look, a generation is going to come and a generation is going to go, and the generation that comes after you, they're not going to remember you at all. Nothing you do is going to be recounted. They're not even going to know your name. That's the cycle of life, he says. You thrive early in life in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, 50s. But life is like a day. The grass grows early in the morning, but the scorching sun heats it up, dries it out, and by the end of the day, it's blowing like dust. That's your life. A generation comes and a generation goes. Your work's not going to be remembered, ultimately. Let me try to make it practical. Aspire for wealth. We think if we can get wealthy, enough money, we'll either be safe in our retirement or maybe we can achieve some level of fame, some level of success. Wealth is our highest goal. But do you even know who the wealthiest person in the world is today? Anybody know? Carlos Slim. Did anybody know that? No. Wealth is what we want, and Carlos Slim is the wealthiest man in the world. We don't even know his name. Much less do we know the generation before us. Who was the wealthiest person in 1954? We have no idea. Or who's the greatest athlete today? We put athletes on a pedestal and we want to be like them. So tell me right now, yell it out loud, who's the best athlete in the world right now? Anybody else? Evidently LeBron is. You're supposed to disagree so I can make another joke, but that was funny enough, so we'll leave it there. Okay, so great. In 2014, LeBron James is the greatest athlete, but you can't tell me who the greatest athlete in 1914 was. That wasn't very long ago. Or to prove this, that a generation comes and a generation goes, who is, what's his name, your great-great-great-grandfather? What's his name? You don't have any idea. You don't even know your own family. You're a terrible person. It's forgotten. Everything that we labor for, it's a little bit depressing at first, but the point ultimately is don't chase bubbles. Here's what it's like, your work. 3.5 years ago, a tornado hit downtown Raleigh. It hit our neighborhood. It did a lot of damage. One thing we lost was a 100-year-old pecan tree. It was just massive in height. And when it fell over, the root ball was about 10 feet high. It was so big that you couldn't get a stump grinder in to grind it down. And so for literally months, every morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., I would climb up on top of the root ball with chainsaws and pickaxes and little handsaws, and I would just grind this thing down. It was excruciating work. And then at the end, I had this giant pile of mulch, but I didn't want mulch in the middle of my yard. And so I spent the next month taking a wheelbarrow, filling it up, taking it to the back of the yard, and dumping it in the woods. Now, this is a true story. My daughter was on the porch. The moment that I got it flat and felt like I had accomplished something, I didn't realize there was a sinkhole underneath it, and I fell up to my waist in this sinkhole. I almost went insane. I had to take the wheelbarrow, take it to the back of the woods, and start filling it back up to bring all the dirt back to the... And my neighbors probably thought I was the craziest person on the planet. That's what Solomon says your work is like. It's just this endless toil, and it never does what you think it's going to do. Are you really going to give your whole life to being a workaholic? Are you really going to do that? So Solomon's wife is angry. He's a workaholic, and it's crushing our relationship. But put yourself in his shoes for a moment, if you will. He's a king. He's commander-in-chief of an army. He's the wisest man ever to live. Everybody wants his time of attention. I can guarantee you he feels like his life is not his own. He's doing his best. Everything defaults back to him. Nobody's happy with him. When he goes to work, nobody's happy with him. When he comes home, nobody's happy with him. He's just really frustrated. He can't figure out how to shake this or change this or move in the midst of this. Now, so many of us are in this place. You really have to take me at my word for this, okay? We've said at the beginning, this is a very practical series, and I want to give you practical advice on this one. If you're in this cycle of being a workaholic, whether you're married or not, it's crushing your relationships, and you need to take three steps with your friend and your spouse. Number one, you need to start scheduling your life differently and communicating about it. Every Sunday night, you should get together with your friend or your spouse, open up your calendar, and talk about every single point that's happening in the next week. For the last 10 years, my wife and I have shared a Google Calendar. She can see everything that happens in my life, where it happens, when it happens. And I communicate with her regularly what to expect so we can make sure that we have right rhythms in our life. And then as the day goes on, I'm constantly texting her. It takes 22 seconds. This is happening next. This is what I'm doing. I'm praying for you. Pray for me. And so she knows the pattern of my days. And we're always checking back up. So we can begin to be honest with each other. And that scheduling allows number two to happen. And this is really important. You're going to have to be patient with each other. When you feel like your spouse or your friend's a workaholic and you're always getting leftover time or no time at all, it's really easy to get frustrated with them and to lay them out very quickly. And this is what you need to do. You need to pray every day to Jesus for patience. Jesus, help me see their perspective. Help me understand what's going on in their life. Help me know that they're working as hard as they can to be home as soon as they can to give me time. And the moment that your friend or your significant other comes in, the first words out of your mouth should be, when you're really frustrated, sweetie, I'm being patient with you. When you speak patience, it changes the environment and it's a lot less likely that you'll go toxic with them and instead have that patience continue to stay there. Calendar well, communicate well in the calendaring, be patient. And number three, it's this, you have to change. It has to change. Here's what you want more than anything else. I promise you this, because nobody has ever said on their deathbed, I wish I had worked more. You want to be 80 years old, walking on the beach or in the mountains, if that's your thing, hand in hand with your spouse, remembering back over the last 8 decades, those moments where you thought your marriage wasn't going to make it, but it did because you were bold enough and brave enough to make changes. Those times where your kids were rebelling, but they came back because you spent enough time with them. You loved them and were patient with them. You remember the time where your faith was tattered and about to fall apart, but you learned that Jesus is enough. And you're in that moment and you're joyful because you're with this person and it took courage and boldness and change. And you can do it. And you should start that today and begin to make those changes. It's not okay to be a workaholic. It's not doing what you think. God wants more life for you, and it's available if you'll do it, if we be obedient to him. Okay, so he's late. It's because he's working too much. What does Solomon want when he comes home? He wants to have sex with his wife. Are you joking me? How do you think that's going to go? Hey, sweetheart, I'm 8 hours late. You're sleeping. Wake up. That doesn't sound like a very good idea to me. Why didn't he just go to sleep? Why didn't he leave her alone? Now, this is the next really important thing in this passage. We're going to have to gain the other person's perspective and know their needs and treat them in their perspective and their needs and not vice versa. I have a really good friend. His job is massive. When I think about his job, I get a headache and I get stressed out, and it's not even my job. I mean, I can't believe what he does. On top of that, he serves the city. On top of that, he serves the church. He has 3 kids. He has no free time. Every minute of his day is taken up. And he tells me he just needs one thing. He just needs to be intimate with his wife. If his wife will be intimate with him, then he's renewed and refreshed and he has what he needs. That's all he needs. For a lot of us here, that's the case. That's reality. But what we usually do is we just see our perspective. As a spouse, you're narrow-visioned, and you're not thinking about the other person's place and what their needs are. You're just thinking about your needs. And your marriage begins to grow apart, and the dignity of your marriage and the intimacy of your marriage begins to fade because you're so selective in your opinion and your perspective that you never incorporate the other person. And until we begin to see the other person's perspective and know their needs, there's no chance that our marriage is going to come together. Now, I know this is not just a masculine thing. I'm not making that assumption. I read a study this week that 80% of marriages, the man has the stronger sex drive. But that's 20% of women. So there's a lot of us who are women on the other side of this. And so it works both ways, where we need to garner the perspective of the other one. Because if not, this is where we're going to find ourselves. It's a real story. I changed the names. Here's the story. Differing perspectives. Josie's body drives me crazy, he says, but she doesn't want sex. It's been months since we've had intercourse. Finally, I put my foot down and told her it had to change. Is it so wrong to want to be intimate with my wife and to have fun with her? That's his perspective. Here's her perspective. Franklin does nothing all day to help me around the house or with the kids. On the weekend, he leaves me home to mow the yard while he goes to a football game with the guys. He hardly says two words to me except when he wants sex. Well, I have two words for him. No way. They feel utterly rejected by each other, and they're dealing with each other in their rejection. And so Solomon and his wife, one of the most important portions of scripture about marriage, they start to deal with rejection and what our response should be. Here's what it says in verse 3 of Song of Solomon. I had put off my garments, how could I put it on? I had bathed my feet, how could I soil them? So Solomon comes on and he's just heaping it on, right? My love, my beloved, my dove. I mean, he's just romancing her in a pretty pitiful way. He's demanding to have sex with her. And she makes excuses for why she won't be with him. The first one is this: I've already taken off my dress, to which Solomon says, right on, that's what I'm talking about. So she realizes that was a terrible excuse. I can't use that excuse. It didn't work. And so she makes another excuse and she says, I've washed my feet already, which for us doesn't make any sense at all. But here's what's happening. She's saying she's gone through the religious rites of the day to be spiritually clean. She's washed her feet, and if she gets up, she'll be unclean and have to go through all of that ceremonial washing again. And so she just went religious with her excuses of not to be with her husband. It's like saying, Jesus told me not to make love to you tonight. That's wrong. I mean, that is a horrible thing to say, and that's what she says, right? They're making excuses. I don't know if you saw an Excel sheet that went around this summer. A man kept track of every reason that his wife said no to him in the month of June, which was interesting, but I found an even better one. And so here's a set of excuses to lighten the mood a little bit. He says this, my dear wife, that's a bad start. During the past year, I have tried to make love to you 365 times. I've succeeded only 36 times. This is an average of once every 10 days. Men, don't keep records like that. That's going to go bad. It's the cleaning of the closet. The following is a list of why I did not succeed more often. I won't read them all, but here are a few highlights. It will wake the children was used 17 times. It's too late 45 times. It's too early 23 times. You pretended to be asleep 18 times. Down a little bit. There was company in the room next door. That's weird. 8 times. Windows are open and the neighbors will hear 9 times. Close the windows. That's brilliant. I mean, just close. It's too hot 15 times. It's too cold 7 times. And then he says this, during the 36 times I did succeed, our intimacy was lessened due to the following. You chewed gum the whole time 6 times. You watched TV 5 times. You said, hurry up and get this over with 17 times. You fell asleep 6 times, and then my personal favorite, you never moved and I thought you were dead twice. Okay, and so look, to assure you that I don't think that this is just an issue between men towards their wives, but it goes both ways. Here's a much more realistic quote from a woman. She says this, if I hear one more woman gripe about her husband nagging her for sex, I think I'll scream. She should be glad he wants her and finds her desirable. I've tried everything to get Mike interested in me, sexy nighties, creative encounters, heaping praise on him, but he just ignores me. It's a knife in my heart. Rejection is an immensely powerful thing. It can happen relationally. It can happen spiritually. It can happen emotionally. You can reject somebody's personality and their playfulness, and you can certainly reject them on a sexual level. If rejection is a part of your friendships and a part of your marriage, the effects are immense. They are massive to the very core of who that other person is. Rejection says, regardless on what level it is, my needs are not important to you, my heart's not important to you, and you don't really care about me. And when you communicate that, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally over time, that person loses their dignity and the marriage begins to erode away in the very midst of your presence. Okay? If you're the one that's been rejected, listen, don't be oversensitive. You might have misheard something. You might have misunderstood something. They might have had an overwhelming day. They might be pressured beyond what you understand. Okay? So don't make it a bigger deal than it might be. What we often do is respond to one rejection with another rejection, and our marriages become this spiraling down system of rejection, and we wonder why we're having such a difficult time in our marriages. Right? I asked you for something, and you said no, and so I'm not going to pursue you anymore. I don't feel pursued by you anymore, and so I'm not going to respect you anymore. You don't respect me anymore, so I'm going to stay at work later and work more hours and be away from you. And it's because we are quick to respond to one rejection with another rejection, and it just spirals out of control. If you're the rejected one, I know it hurts, but Jesus is larger than your rejection. You need to, in the midst of this most difficult time, begin to treat your spouse like Jesus treated you. You rejected Jesus, you hated Jesus, and he pursued you, and he forgave you in the midst of rejection. It's going to take prayer, it's going to take friendship, it's going to take deep understanding what Jesus has done for you. But it's available for you and for me. If you're the one doing the rejecting, understand this. You hold your spouse's heart in your hand. It's supposed to be that way. And if you're intentionally or unintentionally crushing them with rejection, it's got to stop. What's going on in your life that's so big and so important that you're indifferent to your spouse's perspective and needs? I've seen this in lots of marriages, and it's usually one of a couple of things. But for some of us, we reject our friends or our spouse as a tool of manipulation. You want to get what you want, and you use rejection as a tool, or you're paying them back for something that they've done to you, and so you reject them. If that's you, I want to be direct and merciful. If you use rejection as a tool of manipulation, you're the most religious person on the planet. People hate religion today, but you're the most religious person, even if you say you hate it. Here's why I say that. Religion uses fear, guilt, anxiety, shame, and manipulation to dictate a certain set of actions. You are using guilt, fear, anxiety, shame, manipulation to dictate actions of your spouse and your friends. You're the greatest zealot on the planet. You claim that you hate religion, and you're propagating it more than anybody else. If you use rejection to manipulate and get what you want, today should be the day that you crucify it on the cross and you ask Jesus for help. There's no room for religion. Jesus is here and can heal you of that. We don't like religion here. We're not religious. We're followers of a great God named Jesus who has healed us totally. We need healing in this area. For some of us, we reject because of years of bitterness. The first year of marriage, you feel like you got lied to. You feel like you married a beast. You feel like you married a witch, and it's hard. 3 years go by, and toxicity starts to rise up in your heart. 5, 7, 10 years go by, and that toxicity is monstered up into its adult form of bitterness. If you're bitter towards your spouse, you cannot heal yourself. You can't. Bitterness is consuming, toxicity is overwhelming, and you're in that place. You've been in a relational train wreck, and nobody who's in a train wreck who gets impaled with something metal looks down, realizes that they're bleeding out, and says, I think I'll pull that out and fix myself. No, they yell for help. They know they need a doctor. For a lot of us, you've been a part of a relational train wreck. You can't heal yourself, you need help. That's okay to be there, just don't stay there. There's a lot of folks in the Raleigh-Durham triangle area who are professional, who can help you, who know Jesus, who have been trained, who are way more insightful than you could ever imagine, and you literally need to sit with them as soon as possible. The Bible says over and over, it's the fool who stays to himself, to herself. It's the wise man and the wise woman who goes to get help. Email today, talk to somebody today. Let us help you help yourself. Then the final reason that we reject people that I've seen often in working with people is it's a symptom of self-centeredness. Your whole life is self-centered. Your time is yours. Your money is yours. The way that you do things is your opinion and your way and nobody else's way. And your body belongs to you, and nobody can tell you what to do with your body. Self-centeredness causes you to reject your friends and to reject the needs and desires of your spouse. Solomon and his wife use sexuality to demonstrate this, and so let's use sexuality to demonstrate this. Why do you say no so often to your spouse? Really, why? It's not a rhetorical question. Like, don't answer it out loud. That'd be horribly embarrassing, but why? If you have a health issue, there's a lot of help for you. We can direct you to doctors that can provide help. If you've been abused in the past sexually and there are emotional and psychological and health issues, please, please, please let us get you help. I'm not even advocating for 100% compliancy rate, that every time your spouse asks, you have to say yes. I'm not saying that. I simply want you to understand the importance of intimacy and the difficulty of rejection. And if you're constantly rejecting the other person, you're crushing intimacy and you're causing your spouse to have no dignity at all. It's so important. God said this in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3 through 5. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. Okay, so Paul was not the romantic guy that Solomon was. That's just very straightforward, conjugal rights, okay? And likewise, the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Look, I'm not disrespecting your sexual prowess, but I don't think many people here having sex all night long. It's like 15 minutes. Your spouse wants 15 minutes, and you didn't laugh because you know it's true. Why don't you have 15 minutes for your spouse? Here's what marriage is. Marriage is a covenant between two selfish people to figure out what sacrificial life looks like really. To love each other in the midst of difference and difficulty. See, love is not an emotion. Love is not something that is just a feeling. It's not just romance. Love is primarily sacrifice and service. And the greatest act of love is sacrificing for your spouse, where you're different and you begin to merge two different desires into one. So sometimes sexuality is a tornado, like we started the series, and you just get consumed by it, and it's passionate, and it's good. And sometimes sexuality is just an act of service. And because you understand your spouse's perspective and their needs, you gladly enter into it to love them and to pleasure them and take care of them, because that's the very nature of marriage. Listen, the worst thing is an indifferent spouse. You think you're lonely without a spouse. You'll be far more lonely if your husband or your wife is indifferent to you. And if you're the indifferent one, you're creating a cold hell to live in. And today should be the day that you begin to go to Jesus, find forgiveness, and forgive your spouse and seek depth. If you want passion, if you want mercy, if you want communication, if you want pursuit, it's merging two desires, two perspectives into one new one, and sacrificing so you can show your love to your spouse. Here's how we end in the next 5 minutes. They've been rejected. What's their response? How do they respond to each other? Let's finish our time in verses 4 through 8. They say this. My beloved put his hand on the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolts. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am sick with love. Everybody responds to conflict and rejection. And if you're not responding, it's the most childish thing of all. If there is conflict, you need to deal with it, and you have to deal with it in certain ways. Now, there's something ingrained in us that when we're rejected, we just want to get people back. Isn't that the case? Like, if you're honest, somebody takes a cheap shot, you're going to cheap shot them back. Like maybe you've heard this story. This wife had a very important interview. It was the most important interview of her life. And so she picks her best outfit out. She puts it on. She asks her husband to zip up her zipper in the back. And like most husbands, he plays too much. And so he grabs the zipper and he goes up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And he rips her outfit. And she turns to him and says, "You're going to get yours. I'm going to get you back." She puts something else on. She goes to the interview. When she comes home, she finds her husband working on his car in the garage underneath the car. So she thinks to herself, "I'm going to get him back." She walks over, gets on her knees, grabs his zipper on his pants. He goes up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. Laughs hysterically, goes inside, puts the stuff down, looks over, and at the kitchen table, her husband is sitting right there. And she goes, "Oh no, why are you here?" And he says, "Well, this is my house. I live here." And she goes, "No, no, you're in the garage under the car." And he goes, "No, Bob the neighbor is under the car in the garage." She's horrified, runs outside to apologize. Bob is laid out flat because when she grabbed his zipper, he jumped up, hit his head on the car, and passed out with the pain. Now, that might not have happened to you, but you have some story of wanting to retaliate and the retaliation going bad, and you wish you hadn't done that. And so when conflict hits, how do you respond? Are there 10 things that you have to do? No. 5 things? Nope. Just 1. Treat your spouse like Jesus treated you. That's it. That's what Solomon and his wife do. They have significant issue here. What's Solomon do? He realizes he's being a jerk, and so he gives her space. What does Solomon's wife do? She knows his perspective and his needs, so she pursues him to take care of him and to love him. That's the nature of responding. The more mature you get spiritually and the more mature you get relationally, the quicker you are to make decisions like this. After 18 years of marriage, Kimberly and I are much more able to do this. You see, early on, I could get angry really quick and I could lay her out. How dare I respond that way? Had I forgotten what Jesus had done for me? Like I'd sinned against him to a point where he died for me. That's humbling. I dare not treat my wife like that anymore. Have I forget how patient Jesus was with me? No, not anymore. I remember now that I turned my back on him over and over and over, and he was patient with me. I have no concept of how Jesus is as patient with me as he is. I'm patient now with my wife more than I ever have been. When I realize that she hasn't been merciful to me, I default to grace, or at least that's my hope. Because I remember what Jesus has done for me. When I hated him and when I mocked him and when I stood with the others who were crucifying him, he looked at me and he said, "Father, forgive him, for he knows not what he does." And he forgave me. So if you want your marriage to become deep and rich, if you want to overcome this hole that you're in right now that seems like it's impossible to find healing, it begins with you. It begins for you knowing what Jesus has done for you. And this is really true with every friendship that you'll ever be in. You look at your spouse and you ask one question: what does God want for Kimberly? What does God want for my coworkers? What does God want for my neighbors? He wants you to treat them like Jesus has treated you. That's it. When you're unlovable, he loved. When you're unforgivable, he forgave. When you had no mercy, he poured on grace after grace after grace. And when you were intolerable, running the other way, he was patient with you, so much so that he ran after you and pursued you. This is the greatness of Jesus. And this greatness of Jesus, who lives inside of us as followers of Christ, can bring us to a place where we're patient, where we work on real issues, and where we trust him to bring healing to our hearts and our minds and our souls. Marriage is beautiful, and it's really difficult. But there's one who overshadows all of our marriages and looks down in on it, knowing you and your spouse, and can heal you this day. So let's pray now that Jesus heals us in his great power. Jesus, how good you are to us. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Nowhere else will we find the mercy of Jesus. No other religion would say this, that in the midst of our sin, the God of the universe died for us. No other place will we find mercy upon mercy upon mercy. There's no other name in which we can claim help and Jesus be right there to help. Father, we do not deserve your love. We're unlovable, but you have just showered it on us. We do not deserve your purity, restoring our marriages in the midst of all kinds of brokenness and sexual sin. But you alone can bring righteousness in the midst of our hearts, in the midst of our chaos. We don't deserve your patience, Lord. You should be quick to crush us. But it says that you're not willing that any should perish, but you're patient, waiting for us to see you and be changed by you. And so, God, we ask that this day you would help these things be rooted into our lives. That as we deal with each other, the spiritual community, that we would be quick to give patience and mercy and love to one another. That we would default to grace and we would be defined by mercy. And that, God, that would seep and saturate itself into our marriages. God, that we would be humble men who are strong and tender with our wives. That you would give us a perspective that Jesus led the way in humility, not considering himself equal with God, but dying even death on a cross so that we might be redeemed. And that we would look at our wives and we would be glad to die to ourselves so that the greatness of Jesus might be known by her. And that, God, as wives, we wouldn't go to the part of Ephesians 5 that says, submit to your husbands first. We would go to the first part of Ephesians 5 that says, imitate Jesus. And as women, as we begin to treat our husbands like Jesus has treated us, it changes us to the core of who we are. We deal with our husbands in mercy and in patience and in kindness. Jesus, there's no place, there's no one, there's no thing like you. And this day we sit in your presence and we say, thank you, for you have treated us in a way that we did not deserve. You gave us love and mercy. How good you are to us. And it's in your name that we pray these things. Amen.